We are in a text this morning that is a profound text. I know all scripture that God has breathed has worth and value and is powerful, but I will tell you on a personal level, there's something that happens in 2 Timothy chapter 4 that even feels more sacred to me. The reason it feels even more sacred is because we are reading the last words that the Apostle Paul will ever speak on the face of this earth. He will write this page, and this old lion of God who taught us what it was like to love the Lord, this old lion of God who taught us what it's like to follow Jesus Christ, this old lion of God is headed off to the executioner, and we will read the last words he'll ever write. It's not just that he has been our teacher, but quite frankly, if you've spent enough time in Scripture, he becomes a very good friend. And this friend who models what it's like to follow Christ, his voice will be silenced. Yeah, it's worth our attention this morning. The text this morning, and I'm assuming that you read it during the song service. The text this morning is 2 Timothy chapter 4, but I still want us to read it again. Would you stand for the reading of the text? In the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who will judge the living and the dead, and in view of his appearing and his kindness, I give you this charge, preach the word. Be prepared in season and out of season, correct, rebuke, and encourage with great patience and careful instruction. For the time will come and men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they'll gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. And they'll turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths. But you keep your head in all situations. You endure hardship. You do the work of an evangelist. You discharge all the duties of your ministry. For I'm already being poured out like a drink offering, and the time has come for my departure. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all those who have longed for his appearing. May be seated. It's pretty obvious by watching the daily news. It's pretty obvious by just living life. You have almost no control over when you'll die or how you'll die. You please know, any great thought you give about when you'll die and how you'll die, those are really wasted thoughts because you have almost no control over that. You watch the local news, and you can be just a young boy fishing with your grandfather in Oklahoma, and somebody's shooting at a snake out of a birdhouse two or three properties away, and your life may come. You can be on a bridge crossing the Mississippi, and all you're headed to is some birthday party. You're trying to get down to pick up something at one of the office stores that you can take. Biggest problem you had is you're out of printer ink. And the next thing you know is you've reached the end of your world. You have no control over when you're going to die or how you're going to die, but you do have control over this, how you're going to live. And how you're going to live is the central issue that Paul finishes with when he finishes his life, is the sense of how are you going to live. He will use a series of contrasts. His contrasts start in chapter 1, and they run through every single chapter. And it doesn't surprise us when he comes to the last chapter, and he speaks to his dear son, this beloved boy of his, and he says to Timothy, "Timothy, live the same path I've lived on. Follow me the same way Christ has marked out a path, and I've walked in that path. Timothy, come walk in that one. Timothy, come do what I've done." Which is an odd thing for a guy who's been through as many beatings as he's been through, troubles he's been through, hardships he's been through, and a guy headed to the executioner, and he turns to all your sons and says, "Come this way. This is the way to go." On the other hand, there's a whole crowd. That whole crowd will go that direction. "Timothy, don't do it. I beg of you, don't do it. Timothy, please, don't do what they do." Oh, who are they? Well, they've been showing up all four chapters, but notice who they are described in chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. "For the season or the time will come, and men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they'll gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. They'll turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths." He's not talking about the big boys in the pool hall. He isn't talking about the pagan cult down the road. He isn't talking about the temples and those who worship there. He's talking about those who would call themselves by the same name you call yourself. Those who would say, I'm followers of Christ. Those who would say, I'm part of the kingdom. People who sing the same songs know the same Lord's name. Please know, there's a bunch of them go that way, Timothy. There's a small little path that goes this way. Timothy, I beg of you, follow me on the narrow path. Come this way. This morning, we need to stop here for a second and say this. There is no doubt that there is a golden calf syndrome. A golden calf syndrome is woven throughout Scripture. You just can't miss it. The golden calf syndrome basically is this concept. It has to do that anytime God is doing something significant and powerful and wonderful with individuals, there'll be a whole mob that are associated pretty close by that use the same words, speak the same language, on the outside appear much alike, and they are incredibly different, for they're pagan and lost and will be destroyed by the living God. For example, Moses, by God's hand, brings the nation of Israel out of Egypt. You interview any one of the nation of Israel and you say to them, tell me the good things God's done for you, and they will tell you things of deliverance. And they'll tell you how God stacked up the water they walked through on dry land. They will tell you how God has provided their daily bread and how God has done miraculous things for them. They will tell you of their worship, having seen the mountain with the fire on it and the flames and the thunder and the lightning and all those things and worship. They'll all tell you the same thing. But when the dust all settles, you recognize there's a Moses and a Joshua and a Caleb and all of those. They're men of the mountain. And there's a group down there who build a golden calf. Do you really think their golden calf was, we don't accept the God who delivered us? Of course not. The golden calf was a part of how they built a box, and they took their own personal agendas because they had come from a background of sensuality. And because sensuality is a part of our lifestyle, they brought in their own lifestyle, built a box, and tried to shove their worship of God into that box. And that sense of changing what God called them to be to make Him fit their box, that's the heart of the issue. Golden calf syndrome. It'll always occur. For example, you know in the reading through the Gospels that there's a temple where people come to worship. Jesus went to pray. In that temple, you're going to find godly people. Simeon and Anna would be godly people who were there. There's a widow who Jesus points out and says, now that's the woman who understands it. There are people who came to worship at the temple who would have had profound spiritual insight. But at that same temple, there are people who are also sounding the same way, looking the same way, behaving the same way by externals, and Jesus takes a whip and drives them out. Why? Because there's a golden calf syndrome. There always will be. There'll be individuals who, for the most part, build a box of their own agenda. And they will say, God, I will worship you in any way that my own agenda can still be incorporated. And this is the box. Jesus himself has disciples. They will end up maturing, but they're wonderful, godly men that we'll come to know. Great, committed believers. But he also has a crowd. Now, the crowd and the disciples are very, very different. Now, the crowd wouldn't say so. The crowd would think they're disciples. The crowd would say, wow, we hang on every word he says. The crowd would say, we run across the desert to hear him. The crowd would say, we tell everybody you ought to come hear this Jesus. The crowd would say, we're disciples. Jesus stops them in John chapter 6, and I know I'm extrapolating out of the text, but it's still true. Jesus says, stop following me. Quit following me. You follow me because you have your own agenda, and you're trying to fit me into your agenda. Stop it. Until you're willing to follow me on my agenda, you're not disciples. I'm glad for the Church of Jesus Christ being in a community where we throw open the doors and say, those of you who love the Lord, come. But gang, we're kidding ourselves. If you don't wrestle over this issue, am I the man on the mountain? with a surrendered life to the living God, by life or death, whatever you want to do with me, I'm entirely yours, with no other agenda. Or have I got a box? And God, my box of personal lifestyle, that's what I'd like to have. And God, if my personal lifestyle can be maintained, and God, if I can be certain and sure of what's going to take place, and God, if it doesn't require much sacrifice, here I am, God, I'm willing to serve you as far as that box will take me. Who are you? Golden calf syndrome. In this text, I think Paul says there are two things that really, really matter for a disciple. I want to brush across them this morning. There are two things. I think they're two really, really vital things, because I don't think he would have wasted the last chapter he'd ever write on trivial things. Here's what he writes. He writes in verse 6, "My life is being poured out as a drink offering." He writes about a life of sacrifice, and he says, "Timothy, come follow me." He writes in verse 2 about a life of clarity of purpose. And on those two things, I think ultimately the Christian life, I'm going to take them in reverse order the way that Paul wrote them. I'm going to take them from verse 6, a life of surrender and sacrifice, verse 6, and a life of clarity of purpose, verse 2. You realize, don't you, that the entire Christian life is built around an odd mix of two things. The odd mix of two things in the Christian life is certainty and uncertainty. Those two are wed together. Meaning what? Meaning if you follow Jesus Christ, there are some things you can be certain of. You can be certain he's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and he is the Creator. You can be certain of that. You can be certain he reigns, and that this world is his, and nobody's going to kidnap it or take it anywhere else. It's still his world. You can be certain of that. You can be certain that when you die, you will behold him face to face. You can be certain of that. You can be certain of any number of things that he has promised and said within his character. But here's a funny thing. There's a great deal of the Christian life that is very uncertain. What would he do with you? If you really gave your life to him, what would your life turn out to be? What would it look like? That's pretty uncertain. Oh, I mean, you understand you look like Jesus, but tell me, what would he require of you? How much sacrifice? What would it turn out to be? Let me use a quick illustration. 1 Samuel chapter 14. In 1 Samuel 14, Jonathan and his armor bearer are in the middle of a battle. And when I say battle, it's a stalemate. Because the Israelite nation keeps running and the Philistines keep chasing them. It's a stalemate. They're not fighting much. Well, why aren't the Israelites, why aren't they fighting? Well, they only have two swords. For the whole army? Yeah, for the whole army. Today's your turn. Okay, you can have it today. What do you do with an army that only has two swords and the enemy has lots of swords? Well, what do you do? Well, King Saul's a pretty carnal man. He just basically avoids the Philistine army. But Jonathan, his son, is a godly man. Jonathan knows from 1 Samuel chapter 7 that God has promised, "I will drive out the Philistines." Now, he didn't know when, and he didn't know by who. But Jonathan basically wakes up his armor bearer one morning and says, "You know what? There's the two of us. Let's go take them on." His verse that he uses, the promise that he uses is God says, he says about God, "God can win victory, but whether by many or by few." Let's go take him on. Now, can you hear the conversation? The armor bearer says, "I believe that. But is today the day he's going to do it? And what about us? Will he let us live?" And Jonathan's answer is, "Well, I'm not sure about all those things." And the armor bearer says, "Wake me up when you are sure, okay? Please wake me up when you are sure." Actually, that's not what he says. The armor bearer says, "Heart and soul, I'm with you." And they go out. And here's the word that Jonathan uses, the word perhaps. It's in that text. Perhaps God will use us this day. Jonathan had no way of knowing whether he would live or die. All he knew was, I know who you are, God. I know what you want for the big, I know what it means to get in the middle of your will. Now, whether I live or die, that I don't know. Here I am, take me, no strings attached. And Jonathan wins this humongous victory. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Again, combination of certainty and uncertainty. And this great big idol is erected. When this great big idol is erected, the king says, bow down and worship it. And they say, no. The king says, I can kill you. And they say, yes, you can. I'm like, yes, we're pretty confident you can kill us. But our God is able to deliver us as well. But should he not, we still won't bow down. It's a combination of two things. What is it? Certainty and uncertainty. I know what's right. I'm going to go put myself right in the middle of God's will because I know what the will of God is. That's what I'm going to do. Now, what will happen to me? I'm clueless on. I don't know. You see, biblically, God does some really odd things. He sends an angel to let Peter go. I love that passage. Oh, good. You mean if I surrender my life to you, they can't even lock me in a Roman prison. You're safe. Angels might let you go. Oh, great. I like that one. But I also had James in there, and they cut off his head. Well, now, wait a second. Now, which one am I going to be? Randy, you don't get to decide. Randy, you get to decide whether you want to be in the middle of my will with no reservations, with no conditions. And Randy, if you're willing to serve me with no reservations and no conditions, I could use you. You're mine. But if you start building the box and you start saying, I'll serve you, God, as long as it doesn't impact my financial lifestyle much. I'll be generous if you promise that I'll keep lots of money in the bank and can always pay all my bills very, very well. No, Randy, I'm not going to make that promise. Well, I'll serve you if you promise that it doesn't involve anything strange or weird, okay? Because I don't want to be strange or weird. I mean, I'll serve you as long as it looks heroic and wonderful, but don't make me make a fool of myself. Well, you promise that I don't have to look foolish in the eyes of anybody else. Randy, I'm not making that promise. Well, I'll serve you. Randy, you just build a box. Welcome to the golden calf syndrome. You can go ahead and join the crowd down there. I'll tell you, there are real disciples over here, sold out. Can I ask you this? Are you living with or without a box that poured out, no reservations? Is it you? That's what Paul says. Timothy, come live that one. On a personal note, my story is just my story, and God will write my story different than he does yours. So don't take mine and try to import it too much into yours. That wouldn't be fair, but I can tell you the principle will be the same. I grew up among a people that had both the golden calf syndrome and men on the mountain. And I was among the golden calf crowd. I was quite willing to serve God, but I had quite a few conditions. I was in high school, and I remember in particular that there was a way I wanted people to see me and think about me, and that's part of my condition, God. I'm willing to serve anything as long as people will still see me the way I want them to see me. And God, I'm willing to sacrifice as long as it doesn't involve some of these kinds of changes. And I wrestled with God, and one of the great wrestling matches with God was, God, I don't know what you would do with me, and I'm scared. The bejeebers are scared out of me. If I really gave you my life, I have no idea what you would do with me and how you... It terrifies me. God, I will surrender when I could be more certain what you would do with me. And that, dear friends, is a request he will never honor. A surrendered life. That's the demarcation line. Speaking pretty frankly, I wanted to stay local. I wanted to stay where my family was. I wanted to not move in a moving van every 2 years. I knew basketball coaches and football coaches and preachers, and preachers move more often than bad basketball coaches. I knew I would live my life in a moving van. I knew that God had given me some gifting that had something to do that if I wanted to bring my act of worship and say, God, here I am, I knew there was a chance it might involve this, and I ran from it. I was ever bit as much as Jonah as anybody else. I ran from it. I did not want to do this. Only sort of like people to start with. I'm joking. Well, you did. I wanted to run from this. In particular, it wasn't this location kind of thing that scared me. I had a fear. I'd grown up with missionaries around our kitchen table all the time. I had a fear that somehow I would be uprooted out of the rural community. I'd be taken out of family. I'd be taken where this whole moving van thing, the extreme, I'll be in the mission field somewhere. God, I'm not willing to do those sort of things. There's not much difference between me and the rich young ruler, except he had money. But I had the same response. God, if that's what following you requires those kinds of things, I don't want to do them. And that was my wrestling match. You don't need the whole blow by blow, but I'm going to tell you some interesting things that occurred. My life was turned upside down, and bit by bit,
I finally came to a place where I said, God, even if it involves the mission field, here am I.
That was a pretty powerful thing for my life. You had the same pathway. It wasn't long after that that Julie and I, we were married at the time, and a guy came along and pretty well convinced both of us of an opportunity that we needed to take up in New Zealand. And my wife and I made the commitment to go to New Zealand as missionaries. For me, that was taking my box and dumping it out. We raised most of the money. I mean, we had quite a bit of the money raised. We were headed to New Zealand. They had 53 churches over there without preachers, and we were going to be the kind of a circuit where I'd take about two or three of those churches. Out of my comfort zone, I know that New Zealand's not exactly like where they, you know, have headhunters and boyo for supper, you know, but it was outside of my box. Box that I had to tear up. I know that my sacrifice is nothing like Abraham's, so please, I understand apples and oranges, but I will tell you, it's a funny thing, trudging up that hill and saying, God, whatever you want, as painful as it is, I'm willing to do. No reservations. And God accepted that. Something broke in my own heart, and my own life began to reflect more of what it means to be a disciple. Some of you are going, did you go to New Zealand? About 2 weeks before Julie and I were to graduate, we were denied the work visas. The country of New Zealand said, no, you can't come in. I believe to this day, God's a bit of a rascal. To this day, I think God's a bit of a rascal. I think it was almost like Abraham. I think it was until you're willing, until you yourself know in your own heart. I think God already knew, but until you yourself are willing to come to the place, no reservations. And God switched out. And really, through no doing of my own, quite frankly, he ended up putting me, literally, he put me here at this intersection and has let me stand here for the rest of my life, so to speak. God has been incredibly good to me. He would have been incredibly good to me had we gone to New Zealand. But a sovereign God who's got a pretty singular condition. You don't get to follow me with a life without sacrifice. Tell me, are you living in a life without sacrifice? One where you'd be generous if you know your finances were okay? One where you'd be, are you doing that? This morning I got part of the story to a family that I got acquainted with. I joined the family. I spoke at Brown's. I've been a lot of places the last month. I haven't been here, but I've been speaking. I've been traveling quite a bit. Brownstown, Illinois, I did a family seminar. It was a family I enjoyed getting acquainted with. Delightful Christian couple, fun to visit with. I enjoyed them very much. And then found out they were aunt and uncle to Debbie Wimple. And so they're telling me about Debbie and family and all those sort of things. And we're praying for Seth and his health and all of that. But so I enjoyed them. They were a delightful Christian couple. Debbie told me this morning the rest of the story. She said, you met, you know, the crown jewel of our family or something like that. I forget exactly how she worded it. But she said, did you hear about the carpet fund? No, I didn't hear about the carpet fund. I said, oh, it's a family joke. And yet it explains a lot about them. Debbie said, you know where they live, don't you? Yeah, they live in that house just across from the church. I wasn't in their house, but I saw their house. It's just right there. Said, well, when they got married and they moved in that house and all the sort of things that went along with this story, said,
they're scrimping their money, saving, trying to get it up to buy carpet for the house. And they got the money saved up, and when they did, they found somebody in need, and they gave the carpet for away. So they saved and saved and saved and saved again. They got the carpet money, and so the family joke now is they're always saving carpet money. And every time they get there, they give it away. And then Debbie looked at them and said, there's still no carpet in the house. And some of you go, wow, that's a scary thought to live an uncarpeted life. And the truth we know, they are joyful and vibrant and alive. You see, if you live as men on the mount, you have a whole different life than those who live in the golden calf, who say, God, I'll serve you as soon as we get the carpet all in, as soon as we get this done, as soon as that gets done, God, we'll be going through that. There is no substitute for faithfulness, sacrifice. Now, does everybody wrestle with this? Yes. I wrestled with it hard. I was fearful what God would do with me. My daughter shouldn't be as tall as she is. Katie's sitting back there. Katie's hardest single spiritual struggle by far when Katie's a little girl growing up. I'm just being transparent with her life. It's easy for me to do. Katie's biggest struggle was, what if God would demand the hardest things for me to give? What if God, and Katie had to wrestle through, do I want to give all my life to God when I don't know what's going to happen? And the answer to that to all of us is, yeah, you have to. You will worship God with uncertainty of the moment. That is God. That is God. I love a line by Irwin McManus. Irwin McManus is the one who I've heard it from. Irwin McManus says that the Christian life starts off with once upon a time. It really does. Jesus, can I tell you about my God? Once upon a time. The story ends and they live happily ever after. But there's a whole bunch of mystery in between. And you just live out the mystery. And you're not sure what's going to be that mystery. But here, my God, take me. As mysterious as it is, if I'm Peter and you want to let me loose by angels, do it. If I'm James, you allow them to take my life. So no reservation. I mentioned there's two things in this text. The second one is a clarity of purpose. You have to be able to live a life of sacrifice. The second one's in verse 2 where he says, preach the word. In season, out of season, when it's popular, when it's not, you preach the word. Verse 5, you do the ministry or the work of an evangelist. Let me take verse 2 and verse 5 and just summarize them in general terms. Here's what they are. It is telling the story of Jesus Christ. That's what it is. You tell the good news of Jesus. Verse 5, that word evangelist is always used in association with someone who tells about Jesus. In fact, that's why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are called by the church fathers the evangelists. Why? Because they tell you about Jesus. That's why Philip is called an evangelist. Why? Because he tells you about Jesus. The thing that we have to tell is just the story of Jesus. We don't have enough goodness. We don't have enough politeness. We don't have enough natural charisma of some kind. We're not interesting enough people that the whole world just blessed by our presence. The only thing the world's blessed by is that the story of Jesus Christ was entrusted to us, and the story of Jesus Christ changes lives, and I'm going to tell you his story, and then I also want to tell you how his story has changed my story. It's changed my story enough that I'm going to spend the rest of my life with clarity of purpose telling people of the story of Jesus. That's life. Are you a disciple or are you part of the crowd? Well, let me ask. Tell me about your story of surrender and sacrifice. How did it look last week? And tell me how you've been telling the story of Jesus. Those two things side by side. That's it. That is the Christian life. It is funny how telling the story of Jesus lacks so many specifics on how to tell it. Oh, man, I know the story. It's clear in Scripture. But how do you tell it? Well, if I trace Paul down, I found he told it at every opportunity. If finds a woman beside a river and she's in worship, you tell her. You're in a jail and they got you locked up, you sing it and tell it. The jailer comes out to check on you, you tell him. You go house to house and tell it. Book of Acts. A lot of ways you tell it. I want to borrow this from a guy named Ben Miller. Ben's a young, sharp guy. He's one of the campus ministers. I was with about 30 campus ministries and speaking to them last week in Evansville, Indiana. And he's one of those guys.
Ben Miller said, it's amazing how the important things in life don't come with step-by-step instructions. Now, some minor things in life come with very, very specific instructions. Do point one, do point two, do point three, do point four. He said, but we brought our babies home, our little boys home from the hospital, and there was nothing pinned to their diaper. Step one, step two, step three, step four. It wasn't there. The important things in life, you don't get step-by-step things on. You really don't. The important things in life, there are no step-by-step things. What there is a heart, and now it's so important you figure it out. For example, the only thing we really knew we had to do is have a heart for our boys. And we had to love those boys and do what was best for them and pour our lives into theirs. But there were no step-by-step instructions. So when one of the little boys is bawling in the middle of the night, do you go lay down beside them and cry with them? Sometimes you do. Sometimes you say, you know what? That would hurt that child for me to go in there and cry with them and be in the same bed. So you put them in bed, you close the door, you go sit in the hallway, and you cry outside in the hall. Nobody tells you exactly how to do it. It's too important not to figure out for yourself. Telling the good news of Jesus Christ and preaching, no one can say, okay, today at 2, do this, today at 3, do this, today at 5, do this, when you encounter so-and-so, do this. Nobody can tell you that. But if you belong, like men of the mountain, who encounter the living God, you'll care enough, you'll figure out a way to do it, the same way you raised your kids or anything else. It matters too much not to do. This week, got to go out to supper at a Greek restaurant in Evansville. Dean, who was with us, and we were talking about prayer life as we were going, and the pattern fits a lot of us in some ways, but his is a little more regimented or definitive than ours. But he talked about he likes to find the name of the waitress, in particular, if possible, try to get prayer requests from her and correspond back and forth with a waitress on a prayer then. So Angie comes up to us, and Dean starts his conversation as he often does, and many of us in this room have done similar kinds of things, but he said, Angie, he said, there's not a lot we can do for anybody not living here in Evansville, but one of the things we can do is we can pray. Angie, anything we can pray for you? Anything at all, Angie, sir, we can pray. And Angie kind of blew it off. Oh, you can pray for everything kind of thing. And then she moved around where I had a little better angle to and it was just more natural for me to carry the conversation. And so I said to Angie, no, Angie, in fact, we talked about it before we came in. We're really serious, Angie. Everybody carries burdens in life. And we just don't want to spend the next hour or two with you that we at least wouldn't do the kindest thing we know how to do, which is just pray for you. At a Greek restaurant, they bring you several courses, which is why preachers start to look like they do after a while. The very next trip, Angie came back, and she said, I had to sit back and cry a little bit back there in the back room. And she began to just open up. She started off with, I just want peace of mind. I just want peace of mind. And there our dialogue started. And we have Angie's name, and we have the restaurant and the address she works at. We didn't want to ask her for her home address. Four scary guys. We got her address where she works. And we're writing, and Angie's been on my prayer list. As we're leaving, Angie comes running and catches us outside the door. Doros is the owner of the restaurant. We had met Doros earlier, just in passing. She said, I told Doros what you guys were doing, and Doros begged, would you mind? And Doros, the owner, had a prayer request. And so we're passing out phone numbers of people that we know that live in Evansville who can connect with. And you just, no, there's no step-by-step of how you tell the story of Jesus, but there are two people, one who owns and one who works at a Greek restaurant, who to know the story of Jesus Christ is the most essential thing that will ever occur in your life. So now tell me again, are you men of the mountain? Or are you part of the golden calf? Are you in the steps of a Paul? Or do you have itching ears for a more comfortable lifestyle? Last thing, as the praise team comes, I want you to notice what's woven through this text. It's delightful what's woven through this text. You say, God, you're asking me to sacrifice everything, no restraint. God, you're asking me to spend my whole life telling the news of Jesus, yeah? God, how do I do that? It's answered by this one little thing. Notice chapter 4, verse 1. I used to read that as a more commanding voice. In the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, I don't read that in more commanding voice anymore. I read that in the presence of God. In the presence of God. That's quite a phenomenal concept. Everything I'm asking you to do won't occur out here solitary in the presence of God. And he picks up the concept. Look, go to verse 16. At my first defense, or my last, that's this last trial he's talking about, no one came to my support, but everyone deserted me, may not be held against them. But the Lord, he stood by my side, and he gave me strength. Whatever I'm asking you to do is not a solitary journey. You think Jonathan had a nice advantage with an armor bearer? Look what you got. I'm asking you to surrender. I'm asking you to go into uncertainty. But I will be with you. I will strengthen you. Do you notice the last words of the Apostle Paul on the face of the earth? The last words that we know that he'll ever write are these words. And may the Lord be with your spirit. Grace to you. If you really believe that God would stand beside you, would you live a life of sacrifice and surrender of whatever it required to be faithful? No reservations. And tell the story of Jesus. If you will, it's family of God. And if you won't, you're living with tickled ears. And you're living in the golden calf syndrome. This morning during this invitation, you better know which crowd you're in. May God bless.